Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. It is the merry occasion of our 15th year on the air. I want to thank everybody who has kept us on the air for those 15 years. And that's the sum total of our celebration. We're going to give you a question of the week that's going to help you celebrate the making of compost in your garden correctly. And mostly we're going to celebrate by taking our favorite thing, your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Daniel, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Daniel. How are you?
I'm doing just fine.
And where is Daniel fine?
Well, I am a brand new transplant to the Philadelphia area.
And what part of the city?
I am in the Northeast.
The Great Northeast or the...
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Daniel in the Great Northeast?
Well, I recently got my hands on a townhome with a absolutely wonderful skylight, and I thought, this thing has such great light, I bet it could grow something in here. So I went and bought a lemon tree. As it turns out, it is doing quite well, given how large it turned out to be. It's actually about a 2 to 3 foot tall tree right now. And it's all potted. It's mostly potted soil with a little bit of citrus soil mixed in. But very oddly, some of the leaves have started to yellow a little bit, but not all of them.
Right.
And I have never grown something this large before, let alone a tropical plant. And I was wondering, is the skylight giving it enough light, or is it something else that's causing the leaves to yellow?
Well, you know, citrus, a lot of people will move them outdoors for the summertime, but citrus in the Northeast is mostly an indoor plant. And the idea is to give it as much light as possible. A skylight sure sounds good to me, as long as the hours of light that come from the skylight are considerable.
Yeah, I get basically sun up to sundown. I don't have to turn the light in the room. So it's pretty substantial.
Okay.
The amount of light that comes through that thing.
And the skylight is well insulated, so on cold nights it's not getting drafty there?
No, it's not insulated, but it is. The house is kept very warm. It's a row home, so there's a lot of heat coming from the other units, and it's about 75 degrees on any given moment.
Oh, okay, so you're Al Gore's bitter enemy here.
Mm-hmm.
How far from the actual skylight is the top of the tree?
Oh, I'd say a good 6 feet, I'd say about.
Okay, and how often do you water?
Well, I got a mister because I read you have to mist the leaves, and that gets done every day. Every 3 to 4 days, I try to water it.
Mm-hmm.
I do the finger test where I stick my finger in and see how far down it gets before it gets wet.
Well, you know, indoor citrus is one of these plants that likes more water than most house plants. Your finger method would kill a lot of house plants, because I doubt that you have fingers deep enough to go down to the bottom of the root system. And as long as there's water down at the bottom of the root system, the plant is getting all the water it needs. Now, you don't let water sit in any saucers underneath, do you?
Well, actually, there is a saucer underneath, but I've never had enough water so that it drains down to the saucer underneath.
Really? And what kind of pot is this?
Ceramic pot.
Okay, so that's, and it's terracotta, it's not glazed.
No, it's terracotta.
Right. So it's wicking its moisture into the air. And your air is going to get very dry over the winter. Your timing could not be better. If you were a brave man, I would suggest you repot it into a plastic pot, simply so that the water loss would not be so dramatic. So you are going to have to water more than less, because especially if your house gets dry, if you don't have a humidifier going in the wintertime, if your house gets dry, it'll dry that houseplant soil out. I was afraid you were overwatering. You might be underwatering. Now, this thing is starting to get heavy. Is that one of the things I'm getting from you?
It's actually already pretty heavy. It's a good 2 to 3 feet high off of the soil already. And the pot is a good 24 inches wide.
So you don't, right, okay, so this is not a move it around thing.
No.
All right, I want you to water slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Once a week, but really saturate it. What you do is maybe take a quart container, pour a quarter of the water around, come back 20 minutes later, pour another little bit on, do that like every 20 minutes to a half an hour, And then when you start to see water come out the bottom, stop. If there's any water builds up in the saucer, get it out of there with a paper towel or a turkey baster or something like that. But make sure it is well watered, especially over the winter. And you say you potted it up into soil that is meant for citrus. Do you have any citrus plant food or anything like that?
No, not yet.
I want you to search and find an organic plant food for citrus that makes sure it contains a good amount of magnesium. Your yellowing leaves are a classic sign of a magnesium deficiency in citrus. Citrus has a high need for magnesium. And the best way to supply that is with a complete organic plant food for citrus. But other than that, I mean, I think you're going to have sensational fragrance in the air over winter, and you may not be far away from getting little lemons.
All right. Terrific. Thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Becky, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing very well, Becky. Thank you for asking. How are you?
Good.
And where is Becky?
I'm good in Cuba, New York.
Oh, okay. Cuba, New York. Huh?
Yes, but I'm not down in town in the valley. I'm way up on the very top of one of the Allegheny foothills.
Oh, okay.
So I'm much cooler up there. And this year I've had, not even 10 days that hit 80.
My
tomatoes are mostly green.
Oh, what a sin. Now, that has been an issue for a lot of gardeners. And did you grow a lot of big tomatoes, a lot of heirloom tomatoes?
Yes, I have Mortise Lifter, Amish Paste, and Brandywine.
Oh,
as
okay.
As well as some Early Girl.
Okay, so your Early Girl's ripened up fine for you.
They're orange right now.
Oh, okay. So your Early Girls are just ripening.
Yes.
You turned them into Late Girls.
Well, my weather did that.
Yeah. I've had some cold nights in Pennsylvania. How low have you gone?
36.
You poor thing. How do the plants look in general?
In general, they're pretty green. There's a few, on some of them, there's a few bottom leaves that are yellowing.
Are they producing any new flowers?
Yes, they are still flowering. I don't know whether I should snip those off if that would help hurry along the ripening of the tomatoes.
It is one of the most important things you can do. Those flowers don't have any chance
of
becoming ripe fruits, and all they're doing is taking energy from the plant. So pull off any new flowers. Quite honestly, on big plants like Mortise Lifter and Brandywine, if there's just like little piddly baby tomatoes, pull those off too.
Mm-hmm.
Now, have you been doing anything to protect them on cold nights?
I have stakes in the garden bed sticking up, and I covered that all with a plastic tarp.
Okay.
Clear plastic tarp.
You have
and
to.
And then at night when it does get down to very cold temperatures, then I do cover that whole thing with something more substantial.
Okay. You're saying you're leaving the plastic up all day long?
Yes. It's on the top and partway down the sides.
And so far, the tomatoes are not reacting badly to that.
No, it's open on the bottom, so I think they're getting enough air flow through there. There's some holes in the tarp here and there, too.
Okay, because that can be dangerous if you get a sunny day.
Okay.
And normally, I would yell at you and tell you to go out and buy a roll of row cover. Spun polyester fabric that it's very safe to leave completely over the plants all day and all night. Traps a little heat, prevents frost. But it sounds like you accidentally have a system that's working. I do want to warn other people that a lot of time plastic during the day will cook plants.
Oh, okay.
So you want to remember that. And it doesn't have to be a hot day, but a sunny day. So on a sunny day, if you can take it off or roll up the sides, that'd be great. But overnight, that's good. Pull off all the flowers, pull off all the baby fruits. And then obviously the tomatoes will be damaged if they're out on a night below like 34.
Okay.
So I would certainly advise you from now on where you are, because it is so chilly where you are early in the season, you want to have row covers or something else on top of your plants to keep them warm early on and get them growing fast.
Okay.
You just don't have the climate. And then if there's going to be a hard freeze, bring the tomatoes in that night. Any tomato that is full-sized will ripen up indoors. Keep it away from direct light. Just leave it sitting out on a kitchen counter. And
so you don't need to wrap it in a newspaper or any kind of paper bag or something?
That's a long-term storage technique. If you think there's a tomato that's almost ripe and you want to give it a little push, you would put it in a paper bag with a ripe apple or a banana.
Okay.
Because they give off naturally the ethylene gas that will promote ripening. But if they're full size, just leave them out on a kitchen counter in a cardboard box and they will ripen.
Oh, good.
All right.
Hey, thank you very much. That's lots of good ideas.
All right. Good luck, Becky.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that you'll have a chance to see me give a talk on turning your fall leaves into garden gold live when I perform for the Lower Merion Conservancy at St. Joe's University on Wednesday evening, October 23rd. And then I'll lead a trip to Cuba, that's right, Cuba, to explore their botanical wonders this coming January 14th to the 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be back with more of your fascinating phone calls and what to include and not to include in your fall compost pile. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that late summer is the time to prepare to plant garlic and spring bulbs, and to start pansies, salad greens, broccoli, and other cool weather lovers. Learn more at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and coming up later on our 15th anniversary show, we'll talk about the Fall Leaf Fest to come and why it's important to shred your leaves and what you should do with grass clippings and hay. What about hay? In the meantime, though, lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Andrew. How are you, sir?
I'm doing excellent.
And where is Andrew doing excellent?
I'm doing excellent in West Point, New York.
West Point, New York. Now, I should know where that is, but help me out.
It's the United States Military Academy on the Hudson River, just north of New York City.
Oh, okay. See, that's what a terrible person I am for not knowing that. I can only blame the good sisters of St. Joseph who did the best they could trying to beat an education into me. Okay.
Right.
Are you associated with West Point?
I'm stationed here, yeah.
Oh, okay. Very cool. What do you do?
I'm actually in the world famous West Point band.
What do you play?
Trumpet.
Okay, well, I guess that there are a limited number of options, right?
You could say that.
That's very cool. So you are a cadet?
not a cadet. I'm an active duty soldier. They carry a full-time band here on the academy at all times for heads of state, different ceremonies, things like that.
That's very cool. How long have you been doing this?
Just coming up on 2 years now.
Okay. Wow, and you get to dress fancy and everything.
Yeah, you know what you're going to wear.
Yeah, you don't have to go through your closet every day. Or it's like Superman's closet, right? There's six of the same thing, right?
You got that right.
All right, very cool. What can we do for Andrew in West Point?
Well, we've reached the end of hydrangea season, and I guess we've been out of it for a while. And the blossoms on my hydrangeas have browned and dried up, as they'll do, and they don't look so hot right now. And I've got some beautiful asters next to them, and I feel like their beauty is being compromised by having these dead flowers right next to them. So I would really like to deadhead them, but I've heard differing thoughts on whether to do that or not.
Right.
Some say it's good for the plant, and some say it might not be. So I'm not really sure who to go with.
Oh, well, I got nothing but good news for you here. Now, a lot of times people will want those, quote, dead flowers to persist over the winter. I believe they do produce a little bit of seed that birds eat. And a lot of people like the dried flowers and will even actually use them in winter arrangements and stuff. But I think you might be confusing good advice with the advice you're after. And the good advice is certainly don't be cutting back your hydrangea plants themselves. One of the best interviews we ever had on this show was like the nation's leading expert on pruning hydrangeas. And the first thing this guy says is, I know nothing about pruning hydrangeas. Every year my hydrangeas prove me a liar and I start over again. So we always warn people not to cut back their plants. But that is not deadheading. Deadheading benefits virtually every plant. Cutting the hips, for instance, off of your spent roses is not the same as cutting your roses back, which would stimulate growth and expose them to winter injury. So as long as you are just going to be doing the tidy up, that is cutting off all those big browned balls and not messing with the plant itself, you're golden. And deadheading, removing spent flowers from a plant, tends to improve the following year's bloom.
Oh, well, there's been a further development. My wife and I were talking about whether or not to do it, and so we said, well, let's deadhead one and not the other and see what happens in the spring. But the one that we deadheaded has sort of experienced a second blossoming. There's some new flowers coming up.
This is very common in hydrangeas. There is even a variety of hydrangea called Endless Summer that is promoted as blooming all season long. But in truth, you get those continuous blooms by cutting off the flowers. So, yes, early in the season, if you cut off the dead blooms of your hydrangea, you can force, so to speak, a second flush of blooms. And a lot of people will do this as soon as the hydrangea blooms are open. They'll cut them and use them indoors in arrangements. And then, you know, hopefully they'll get a second flush of flowers. So I don't think it's any danger to the plant. They're very hardy. Just take off the flower heads. And especially, are your asters in bloom right now?
In full bloom, yeah.
Yeah. So normally, if it was just driving you crazy and there was no good reason, I would say wait another month so that you don't induce more bloom. But if those asters are looking great, I understand exactly what you're saying. Go out.
Right.
And to be safe, pull them off with your hands.
Okay.
All right, Andrew?
Well, thanks very much.
All right. You go out and clean that up, and let's see those asters.
All right. Will do.
Take care, man.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Patrice, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hi there, Mike.
Hello, Patrice. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And where is Patrice very well?
Patrice is very well in Santa Barbara, California.
Oh, always a pleasure to hear from our listeners over there. What can we do for Patrice in Santa Barbara?
I just purchased a tuberose plant because I love the heavenly scent of tuberoses. So I have the tuberose in the pot. I have the organic fertilizer, and I really don't know much about caring for a tuberose, and I thought maybe you would have some tips for helping a tuberose to grow and bear those beautiful, fragrant flowers.
Now, did you buy this plant locally or mail order?
I bought it locally at a nursery in Santa Barbara, California.
Okay, good. So they think your weather is warm enough for it.
Well, yes. We are having temperatures in September in the 80s and 90s.
Really? But that's unusual for you guys. Aren't you typically a moderate climate where it stays cool most of the summer but never drops below freezing either?
We used to be, but now with what is known as climate change, we had a very cool summer. August was cool. Now we're having the hot temperatures. And I've been here for many years, my friends tell me that we are going to have our summer in September, October, and November.
Okay, so you've got this thing in a pot, and I guess your intention is to move it indoors and out as the need arises?
No, I'm going to keep it out on my deck because that's where the sun hits in the afternoon, and it's going to get 4 to 6 hours of intense sun during the warm months.
Okay. And when did this plant go into the pot and out on your deck?
Well, I bought it last Friday.
Yeah, it's brand new.
It has unopened blossoms on it, and I went out there this morning, and two of them were open.
And obviously they sold you a good-sized plant that's a couple of years old because it's already blooming. There's two secrets to this plant that I know of. One is that it really loves warm temperatures. In the future, your job is to keep it warm. And if the temperatures drop below, you know, say 45 degrees in the winter time, and you start to see any yellowing of the leaves, you probably do want to bring it inside. In future seasons, these plants typically need about 4 months of warm weather to produce their flowers. So they're kind of late summer bloomers in non-tropical areas. You know, they can bloom year-round, like down in Cuba, you know, or places like that. Now, you say you have organic fertilizer for it. Have you done anything to acidify the soil?
No, because I decided that it would be best to not to disturb it while it's blooming.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And to wait until spring. And when spring comes, I'll repot it with potting soil and the fertilizer, which I have.
Right.
And I also have some fertilizer that I use on azaleas.
Right.
Okay. That has this kind of acid.
You're absolutely correct. You don't want to mess with it while it's blooming. Enjoy the blooms. When it starts to get cool outside, it may be happier indoors than out. But, you know, anytime it's warm, take it outside to that porch or patio where it's getting that warm weather. Warm weather is really important to this plant. It despises cold weather.
Right.
It wants an acid soil, but you're correct not to mess with it until you're ready to repot it next year. And, you know, make sure it's well watered, but don't let any water ever sit in, like, any saucers or anything you keep underneath the pot to protect the surfaces.
Well, that's a good point.
And other than that, if it gets the heat it requires, which is 4 months of warm weather, it should bloom for you year after year. And you're absolutely correct. There are a few plants that have this kind of fragrance.
It's heavenly.
Keep it warm, keep it happy, and just keep smelling every bloom you can.
I definitely will. Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate your tips.
My pleasure. You take care now.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thanks a lot so much for taking a call.
Well, thank you so much for making it. Chris, where are you, man?
Marriottsville, Maryland, about 10 miles west of Baltimore.
Very good. What can we do for Chris west of Baltimore.
Sure. I've got this, best way to describe it is a two-story bunker behind my house that blocks the road noise, I guess, for us. It's covered in grass, and I think it was primarily made from, like, clay and, you know, fill dirt. When I try to water it, the, you know, long and deep, once a week, you know, an inch, essentially all that water just runs down the hill and pools right at the bottom. And so all of that just turns into mud. I'm trying to figure out, are there better watering strategies I should go for? And is there something I can do to make that bunker a little bit more, I guess, able to absorb more water?
Okay. So you have a home.
Yes.
And you have a normal landscape. But then on one side of your home, there's a big highway?
It's a fairly big road. I mean, it's a 50-mile-per-hour roadway, so
and
pretty high speed.
Someone, not you, installed what sounds like a sound barrier?
Yeah, it's basically two-story roadwork. I mean, it's somewhat privacy, somewhat sound barrier, but it's just made out of dirt, and then they put sod on top of it.
And, okay, well, riddle me this, Batman. How do you mow it?
It's rough. Pushing the mower up the hill, yes. But, I mean, it's sloped, so it's like a, I mean, it's a fairly steep slope, but it's something that you can at least, I have an electric mower that I just push up, you know, up it and down it, so.
Does this extend past your house? Does this cover, like, a small neighborhood or something?
Yeah, so there are, like, six houses along the road, and it's basically the back of our houses all back up to this, this highway, and they just built this giant berm, essentially behind all of our homes.
So, yes, the basic answer to your question is drip irrigation, which is little emitters and little small tubes that deliver water very slowly and efficiently right where you want it. But my issue here is we're fighting gravity. Even when you water, what do you do? Do you stand at the bottom and shoot up with a hose or what?
I essentially ran a hose all the way to the top and put, you know, I've got those, the impulse, impact. It makes a little clicking noises and
gotcha. Yeah,
it kind of rolls back and forth.
You're correct. An impact sprinkler.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And you get good water pressure up there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a brand new home development, so we paid extra to, I guess, have public water and sewer installed in the area. So.
Okay, great. Well, what you're going to do, and this is a can of corn. This is a piece of cake, man. You're going to replace that impact sprinkler with a couple of lines of drip irrigation. You'll find this very easy to set up. You'll be able to buy it at different home stores or online. It's a basic tool of organic farming. You see these people who grow in hoop houses and undercover and stuff.
Yep.
Well, they rely on drip irrigation to water their crops. Their crops are protected from heavy rain and too much rain and from being wet overnight. But they're also protected from the rain they need to grow. So what they have to do is run these little drip irrigation lines down the rows, and then they just, you know, turn it on. You can get them with timers built in. In your case, I would have one that you would manually turn on and off because you get a lot of action from rain, especially this past summer.
Right.
You really lucked out. But, yeah, just get rid of that impact sprinkler. How, like, flat is it at the top? How wide?
It's maybe 3-4 feet wide at the very top, and then, you know, extends all the way out to about 20 feet wide at the base.
The basic solution is run some drip irrigation line along the top. You can even taper it down the side, and then just make sure when you're mowing in a hugely high setting so you don't damage the lines, which can be very flat to the ground. You can even, you'll see there's several different types of drip irrigation. There's little pieces of tubing that have holes punched in them. There's little pieces of tubing that sweat. And then there's what's called irrigation tape that is very flat to the ground. And I believe just has the holes on one side. So that would always be down in the grass. So when you mow, it wouldn't be an issue.
Wow. Actually, I might even have that tape. I was using it on the side. If you turn it one way, it acts like a sprinkler. If you turn it the other way, it's almost like a soaker hose.
Exactly. So you want to always have it pointing down. That's going to be the most efficient use of your water. It's going to soak into the soil almost by definition, and run it in the morning. That's when the grass, the almost like the pores of the grass, will be open to receive moisture, and they'll get the most bang for the shortest run. But if it doesn't rain for a week, you could let this drip irrigation run for like several hours in the morning once a week, and I don't think you're going to get any puddling, and you'll get much more even grass grow.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. What an interesting question. Take care, man.
You too.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that it is prime time in most of our listening areas to be growing lettuce, spinach, and other greens, pansies for winter color, and their fine edible flowers, and to be putting cloves of garlic in the ground for harvesting bulbs next summer. But it is not yet time for most of us to be planting our spring bulbs yet. In most of the growing zones, the best time to plant tulips, daffodil, crocus, and such is after Halloween. But don't be looking up why in our Garden Answers A to Z section just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do with all those fall leaves and grass clippings. I wonder what you could make from them. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
You Bet Your Garden host Mike McGrath will lead a small group of adventurous plant lovers on a culturally rich tour of the gardens of Cuba this coming January. Details at earthboundexpeditions.com. Earthbound Expeditions supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops of salad greens, broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, celebrating our 15th year on the air, yay us, by taking your fabulous phone calls and presenting all the information you need to turn your fall leaves into next year's garden gold. Right after a couple more of those fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And where is Tom well?
Haverford, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
Exactly.
All right. What can we do for Tom in Haverford, PA?
Last week, I heard a portion of your show, and you were talking about the lovely great blue heron. You had suggested using water spray to keep them away. I've had no success with that, and I'd also like to say they ignore any statuary that looks like themselves. But what is quite effective, clear monofilament fishing line placed on stakes across your pond in 2-foot intervals. When a bird approaches the pond, his chest will strike the filament, and it spooks him, and he knows that if he gets under it, he will not be able to fly, which is their way of escaping.
Okay, so this was a phone call we got a little while back about a woman who had two ponds with fish in it,
right.
And a heron had figured out that this was better than a Whole Foods being built next door and was showing up earlier and earlier in the season to clean her out. And she had heard the tactic of buying fake birds, which to me, the real bird would only want to fight with or something like that.
They ignore them completely.
But I always do fall back when we have a critter problem on a motion-activated sprinkler. I know at the company's website of one of the manufacturers, they do show it being used against herons and other birds that invade fish ponds. So you tried a motion-activated sprinkler, and it did not work.
Well, yes, mainly because my pond is rather large. It's built like a quarry. It's 55 feet long, and it parts 25 feet wide, and it averages 8 feet deep. And it's surrounded with stone to look like a quarry, so it's difficult for the bird to get down to water's edge. And since the sides are steep, he can't walk in the water.
Did you actually construct this pond to make it difficult for herons and other birds like that to get into it?
Yeah, and raccoons and cats.
So explain to me how the stone works.
Okay, so we dug the pond, and the sides are steep.
Right.
They were building a fish ladder down in Philadelphia near the Gladwin exit of the Schuylkill Expressway. So I was able to secure 60 tons of that stone, which was dropped off in my backyard, and we placed it all around the pond.
And birds don't like walking on the stone?
No, they don't mind, but the pond is down about 3 feet from the top edge of the stone. So in order to get to the water's edge, the bird has to position himself on the stone. And now my fish weigh more than the bird,
mm-hmm.
So when he spears them or tries to capture them, he can't really lift them out.
Do you have this fishing line strung across?
I don't do it anymore because actually it's been a few years since I've seen the heron. But when I get up in the morning and I notice that my fish are down deep, I presume he's been by. But there's been no evidence that he's been able to capture a fish, and I don't think he could lift it out of the water.
So for people with regular size ponds who have not blown up a mountain and used it to make an impenetrable entrance to the pond,
right.
Let's review what you do again. You say you pound stakes into the ground.
Around the perimeter, about every 2 feet, about 30 inches high.
Mm-hmm.
And then from the stakes, you create a grid of fishing monofilament about 2 feet square. And so when the bird approaches, he bumps into the monofilament, and that wakes him up or spooks him. He knows that if he gets under it and walks into the pond, he cannot do his normal exit, which is to fly away. Because as he spreads his wings, he's going to get enmeshed in the monofilament.
And the fishing line is not just around the perimeter. It goes across the top of the pond.
It does in small ponds, yes.
I know the fishing line will just disappear, right? You won't even see it from most
angles. Yeah, it's very hard to see, and I'm not sure he can see it at all. I first saw this at Quality Koi Company, which is in Carneys Point, New Jersey, where I bought my fish. They raised domestic Japanese koi there. And they use this technique to protect their shallow ponds for their young fish that they're raising.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Tom. It's about time somebody gave an intelligent answer on this show.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much, sir.
Goodbye.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Peter, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks.
Well, thank you, Peter. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day here in Vandalia, Ohio. Hope it's beautiful where you are.
Yes, actually, we're having a gorgeous day. What place in Ohio did you say?
That's Vandalia. That's the crossroads of America.
Is it really?
Always has been.
Okay. Vandalia, Ohio. Very good.
Right.
What's it near?
It's the intersection of 70 and Interstate 75. It's about 10 miles north of Dayton.
Oh, okay. Very good. The center of the universe.
You got it.
All right. What can we do for Peter in Ohio?
Well, you can help me save my magnolia bush. I have not been a good tender. I planted it on Mother's Day, and when the drought came around in August, I neglected it for a week and then watered it, and it seems to be hanging in there, but I didn't know if I should do anything as it goes into the fall to kind of make it feel better over the winter.
I'm so glad you called before you did, because most of the things you would do could possibly finish it off more likely than than help it feel better. So you planted a magnolia back in the spring.
Yes.
Okay. Was it in a pot or was it balled and burlapped?
It was in a ball.
And did you remove all the wrappings when you planted it?
I did.
Excellent. Excellent. And did you plant it somewhat higher in the ground rather than lower?
Yes.
Okay. Did you mulch it with anything? Did you water it immediately after planting?
Yeah, so we've watered it through the summer, and then we got neglectful there in late August.
Oh, well, that's not bad. When you first planted it, when you put it in the ground, did you water it immediately afterwards, or did it rain right afterwards or anything?
Oh, no. We drowned it then.
Oh, okay. And by drowning, you let a hose drip gently at the base for like a day.
I actually probably poured a gallon or two, a couple gallons in the top, and it's been doing okay over the summer.
Oh, okay. And then are you just feeling nervous because you...
Yeah, that's one, but it dropped leaves. It has the buds on the ends. But it did drop in a good portion of the leaves.
Right. The big issue with magnolias, unfortunately, you may have researched this yourself, is keeping them really well watered during their first year. Yeah. How bad was your drought?
Oh, it was, say, 2 weeks.
And you didn't do anything?
About a week into it, we woke up and watered it.
Oh, okay. And is it mulched with anything?
There is.
And what kind of mulch is it?
I don't recall. It's something natural, you know, not the kind of stuff you warn people about, you know, with dyes in it or anything.
So it is wood mulch, though?
Yes.
How deep is it?
Oh, you know, a couple inches, three, maybe.
Okay. I don't think anything is wrong. I think everything is going to be fine. If you wanted to be super nice to the tree, you would gently hoe away the wood mulch and maybe give it a light mulch of compost. But that's the only thing you need to do. But as we progress into the fall, if we go through some dry times, don't be afraid to water the tree deeply. And the best way to water a young tree, this is just for general information, is not to pour lots of water on it all at once, because a lot of that doesn't get to the root zone, but it is to drag a hose out there and let it drip gently at the base for a couple of hours. Now, as we get into next season, treat it like a first-year tree. If we do have an extended period without rain, don't be afraid to let a hose drip at the base early in the morning for an hour or two once a week. The tree will really appreciate it as it gets established. But the
a weekly light watering.
Yes, and not really light. It's a deep watering, a slow, deep watering, because it really takes a big plant, even like a lawn, 20 minutes to realize that it is being watered during a drought, and for the roots to open up and become accepting. So it's really the slow drip, drip, drip that really facilitates that. And then just continue that during the first year. But if you paid attention to it up until August, it may have stressed it a little bit, but I think it'll be fine.
Okay, very good.
All right.
Thanks,
Peter?
So
all right, good luck, sir.
All right, appreciate the help.
Bye-bye. Well, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, which we're calling Fall is the Time to Make Compost Magic. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, back with us this week. Nice to have you back. Would you kindly read this anniversarial question?
I'm very happy to be back. And here's our question. We heard from Chenzo in Finland, Pennsylvania, who writes, I just watched the video of your TEDx talk on composting fall leaves and found it to be tremendously enlightening. Can you do the same thing with lawn clippings and or hay? Now, wait a minute, Mike. Is there really a Finland in Pennsylvania?
Well, it sounded fishy to me, too. But MapQuest says it's there, just a few miles north of Philly, outside of Quakertown. Anyway, the answer to our Finlandier's question is no, especially for those grass clippings, for two reasons. One, if the lawn was treated with chemicals, the resulting compost could be toxic to any plants other than grass, as some of the more, quote, modern herbicides can survive even a complete and thorough composting process. And that's the kind of killer compost you don't want to make. Two, grass clippings are 10% nitrogen, which makes them the perfect lawn fertilizer. Using a mulching mower to return those pulverized clippings to the turf provides half the food your lawn needs in a given year. And those clippings help break down thatch by increasing the number of beneficial microbes at the soil line. And three, as I explained in that TEDx talk, compost piles should be composed of at least 80% well-shredded, nutrient-rich, dry carbon materials, specifically fall leaves. Adding too many wet, green, nitrogen-rich grass clippings can really throw the balance off. And trying to compost grass clippings alone just makes a big, stinky mess.
That's three reasons.
I left a tip. Sue me. Now, hay is problematic for the same herbicide reason. Virtually any hay or straw you're going to be able to buy was grown, quote, conventionally, meaning it was fed cheap chemical fertilizers and sprayed with potentially the same kinds of chemical herbicides that make grass clippings unsafe for composting.
Hasn't this also led to the problem of contaminated manures, where cattle have been fed hay that was grown in fields treated with these persistent herbicides?
That's right, and it's a real shame. Adding some horse manure to well-composted fall leaves used to be a great way to add nitrogen to the mix and make a better compost faster. In fact, many old-school organic growers felt that compost with some animal manure in the original mix had the absolute best disease-fighting potential. But these new, highly persistent herbicides have changed everything. If the animals were fed suspect hay or grazed on a treated pasture, their manure could make your seemingly wonderful homemade compost deadly to garden plants. It's just not worth the risk.
Right. And luckily, people can instead use spent coffee grounds to provide the nitrogen that makes better quality compost, which leads us to this question from Patty in Wayne, Pennsylvania. I've been accumulating leaves for years under a giant Norway spruce in my organically cared for yard. I sprinkle coffee grounds on them from time to time, but have never tried shredding them as you recommend. The top layers stay dry and brown, but way underneath there is a layer of dark, wormy soil. Is there a problem with continuing this method? If I need to shred them, what are the best ways to do so? Would running a mower over the pile work?
Well, first, this is a perfect example of why it's so beneficial to just collect fall leaves no matter how you do it. Even unshredded, they eventually become a fine fertilizer, mulch, and soil improver. But the process takes years longer without shredding. And this specific pile could constitute a long-term danger to that tree if the leaves are actually touching the bark or piled so deep that they're preventing water and air from getting to the roots. So the first thing I'd suggest is an old-fashioned turning. Use a pitchfork to move the pile further away from the tree. This will also allow our somewhat lazy listener to harvest that nice finished compost at the bottom. Then, to handle this season's leaf fall, my top choice is to move up to an electric blower vac. They're inexpensive, they shred the leaves as they suck them up, and you don't have to do any bending or raking. But since the landscape in question is organic, you could instead rake, push, or blow the leaves onto the lawn, and then, yes, run them over with a bagging mower. That would shred the leaves and mix them up with a nice amount of grass clippings, creating a perfect combination of the dry brown material that actually becomes the finished compost and a little wet green nitrogen to feed the microbes that fuel the composting process.
So in this case, grass clippings are okay because they're from an untreated lawn, will be really well mixed with the shredded leaves, and will only make up a small percentage of the pile.
That's exactly right. But if your lawn is treated, or it's too much work to drag your leaves all over the place, just shred all the wonderful fall leaves you can with a blower vac, and then mix some spent coffee grounds in as you pile them up. Either way, you'll have great compost for next season's garden. Well, that sure was a somewhat celebratory look at the best ways to use grass clippings and fall leaves now, wasn't it? Well, actually, you know, if you do turn those leaves into garden gold, it'll keep your roses radiantly red. Not sure about the crystal thing, and hey, where's my watch? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to leaven my leaves if I don't get out of this studio. I have no idea what that even might mean. And where are my watches and crystal gifts? Heck, give me a watch with a crystal and we'll call it even. A card. I'll take a lousy card. Anyway, we must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden at whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Fred Snyder. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our well-composted staff includes editor Al Banks, Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, and our production assistant Effie Kahn. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm still way out from collecting full benefits, so I'll do everything I can to see you for another 15 years, starting next week. 1998. Who was president back then, anyway? Clinton? Really? A question about coxcomb from Great Britain sent me on an unexpectedly revealing celosia search. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll discuss the medicinal and food values that make coxcomb more than just a pretty plant. Plus your fabulous phone calls.